Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. So I'm Julian Verguet. I work for Facebook on a project called Hack. And so it's a programming language that we open sourced about 2 months ago. And so Hack is basically, think of it as a statically typed version of PHP that runs on HHVM. So HHVM is a JIT compiler that we develop for PHP, and that's because we have a lot of PHP to run, and we need to run it fast, because we have a lot of machines. And the talk today is not so much going to be about the language. So what I'd like to talk about today is the conversion process. So for the last 2 years, what we did at Facebook is that we converted our PHP code base to Hack. So we went from a dynamically typed language to a statically typed language at a huge scale. And we learned a lot from that process, and I'd like to share some of the lessons that we learned. I'll talk a bit about the language and some of the specifics of the language, but just as an introduction. So first, what's the context? We have a huge code base. So we usually don't give a precise number, but imagine anything between 10 to 100 million lines of PHP. So it's big. There's a lot of code. There are a lot of engineers working on the same code base at the same time. So it's in thousands. They all modify the same code and iterate on that code. The performance, as I said earlier, is absolutely critical. So 1% regression doesn't go in. If you have a diff that regresses by 1%, doesn't go in. It's too much money. The development cycle is very, very fast. We push twice a day. So we push this gigantic thing twice a day. So thousands of engineers, millions of lines of code, push twice a day. So there are a lot of challenges that come from that environment in itself. But before I get into the details of that, I'd like to defend a bit PHP and say why it was a good choice technically to choose PHP. I know, you know, many people like to make fun of it, and PHP lols and PHP whats and whatnot. But it turns out that PHP has been a good technology for us, and we have been very successful with it. So how did it all start? It started with Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm room writing something that looked like this on the left-hand side. And what he was doing back then is that he was trying to build an experience. So there are many different kinds of programming. So when you're trying to build something like a back-end service, all what you care about is throughput, right? Nobody's going to ask you, how does your back-end service feel like? Nobody's going to ask you that. And therefore, the kind of you don't need to iterate as much, because you're going to run the tests and see if the code works or it doesn't. When you're trying to build a product like that, the only thing that you can do is iterate. So what you do is you modify the code, press refresh, look at the experience, and look if it feels right. You play a bit with a website, and then you know, oh, it's not really exactly what I wanted, and you carry on doing that very quickly. And it turns out that PHP allowed that. It was really designed for that, and that's why we've been successful building a lot of products for the longest time by iterating quickly in that loop. But then what happened is this. So basically, we grew. And so what you see, this line that you see, I said at the top, www engineers. Www is the name, the way we call our PHP code base. The amounts of engineers that were interacting with the code base just grew completely out of proportion. And so something was not scaling anymore, right? The whole purpose of PHP in the first place was to iterate quickly. But something was slowing us down, which was refactoring was getting really difficult. Because in a dynamic code base, something as simple as renaming a method was becoming complicated. Because you rename the method and then you're thinking, well, did I catch all the use cases? Is that all complete? And so since we wanted to carry on iterating quickly, it was clear that we needed to be able to refactor quickly. We needed to have tools that guide us when we're writing code. And that's how Hack was born. And so the first line is, I think, the most, the It is a good description of what Hack is. It's basically a statically typed language for HHVM. Now, to get into the specifics of it, it's fully compatible with PHP. What that means is, so it's neither a subset nor a superset, not like unlike TypeScript, but it interoperates with PHP extremely well in the sense that you don't have to write stub code, you don't have to write FFIs or whatever it is. A hack object works directly with a PHP function and vice versa. And then the type checking is instantaneous, but I'll say more about this. And it was designed for incremental adoption. So as you can imagine, we were not going to convert millions and millions of lines of code from a dynamically typed language to a statically typed language like that. We needed to do it incrementally. And that's where the gradual typing comes in. Finally, there are different modes, and it seems kind awkward that I'm mentioning that here. It's just that these modes are important to understand for the conversion. What basically it means is that there are different levels of strictness. And I'll go through these modes later. In a nutshell, this is what it looks like. So I just put on the screen a very, very simple example. And basically, it looks like PHP. And we added type annotation. So here I added the bool, and I added the string, and the rest is inferred, right? So there is more to it than that. There are features that are runtime features, such as collections, such as async await. But I'm not going to mention them here. And I'm mostly going to focus about static typing in this talk. So it looks like PHP, and we added type annotations. What do these type annotations look like? Well, it turns out it's a pretty rich type system. There are a lot of things that you would expect from a type system, such as generics. One interesting type that I think works very differently from most programming languages, at least in Hack, is the nullable type. So the nullable type exists in other languages. It's just that the way it works in Hack is a bit different. It's control flow sensitive, and we've been very careful to make that work gracefully. And the reason for it is that null in PHP is evil. It's nothing like in other programming languages where you just get a null pointer exception, right? So in Java, you make a mistake, something was null, it wasn't meant to be, you get an exception, you look at the stack trace, you debug, problem solved. Null in PHP silently converts to something else and might silently fail. And then you never knew there was a problem until you see some corrupt data in your database and you're wondering where this is coming from. So we paid extra attention to the nullable types, but other than that, it's more or less things that you already know. Another, something that is maybe not very specific to Hack, but that is a bit odd about it, is that normally a type checker is in the front end of a compiler. That's not at all the architecture that we chose. From day one, what we wanted, we knew we wanted an IDE. What I mean by IDE is the whole tool set, refactoring tools, autocomplete, all that stuff. And so when you think about it, an IDE and a compiler, they redo kind of the same work twice. So sometimes the IDE calls the compiler in the background. Sometimes they re-implement some of the inference. But in a way, they're a bit doing the same thing. They both need to know the type of things, and they both re-implement it in their own way. And so we figured, no, what we're going to do is take these two things and make one thing. And so the reason why the architecture is now strange is that instead of being in the front end of HHVM, the JIT compiler, it's a server. It's a daemon that is always running. You start it at first, and it loads all your file in memory, and then keeps track of all the changes that are happening on disk. So it listens to the iNotify events and then keeps the state of the world always up to date. That's as well very important because it's what allowed us to make it to make the type checking instantaneous. So typically, even at our scale, you get type checking results in less than 200 milliseconds. If you make a rebase with, say, 5,000 commits or something like that, couple of seconds to recover. So you're going to get instantaneous type checking no matter what you're doing in the code base. And that was important.
Julian, are you saying that everyone is sharing the same type server?
No. You have an instance per code base. So everybody has, well, it depends what your setup is. We don't have one server for everybody. We have everybody who has their own server on their box or on their virtual box if they're using something in the cloud. But it's one server per user. I should have called it daemon, really. That makes more sense. So, OK, we have a language, a statically typed language. We know how it works, what the type look like. We know what the implementation is. Now the question is, how do we convert the PHP that we have? How do we go from a PHP code base to a hack code base? And so I know that might be a bit controversial, but I think that, well, we'll see. First, the prerequisites to conversion. So before you start converting the Facebook code base from PHP to hack, the first thing you need to ask yourself is it a good idea to begin with? So there are concerns around static typing. And there are reasons why people don't choose static typing in some cases. What are these concerns and how do we address them? Otherwise, we would be, I'll say more about that. The second thing is what was important for us was to have a backup plan. Somewhere where we can say, whoa, we'll do this very incrementally. Don't worry. If things go wrong, we have time to roll back and try again later. It's not something that we did all at once. Another thing that needs to happen is that there need to be zero friction for developers. So what was a non-goal, what something that would have never happened, is the CTO of Facebook going up there and saying, OK, guys, stop what you're doing. We are converting the code base to hack now. This was not going to happen. We still need to ship new products. We still need to develop the code base. And so what we needed was a process that was completely painless for developers. They get to carry on doing what they're doing. And we are converting slowly and part of it automatically, which made a big difference too. Having tooling that basically takes away all the repetitive parts of the conversion. So let's address the concerns first. And so that might be the controversial part. But there is a reason. So I have been in the business of talking about static versus dynamic for quite a while now. It has been a couple of years. And I tried to summarize the concerns around static typing. So if you are a programmer who uses a statically typed language and you're wondering, why don't people use static typing? These are the four big things that come to mind. And there are others, but these, for me, are really the four things that always come back. Too slow. So I'm not talking about the runtime here. I'm talking about the feedback loop that I was talking about earlier. So what they're telling you is, sure, you have this nice thing that catches errors for me statically, but one of my problems is that I have to type this thing make, and by the time it runs, I can go and make myself a sandwich or have a cup of coffee because this thing takes forever. And what I want to do is modify my code and see the result straight away. That's the number one concern from static typing, the biggest one. Then another one is too verbose. So too verbose is, yeah, sure, I have static typing, great, but I have to add all these annotations everywhere. And then it's extra typing that takes away the essence of the code, the stuff that I care about. Another complaint that you get a lot is bad error messages. So basically, you get somebody who's used to JavaScript who will tell you, well, sure, I tried static typing, but it complains. And I don't understand why. It gives me a long trace of things that it has computed, and I don't understand what this message is or what I'm supposed to do. So I feel stuck with this error message that I don't understand, and I don't like that. I'd like to be able to carry on working. And finally, and surprisingly, not so much this last one, but it comes up, is not flexible enough. So there are cases where, yeah, I know there's this object that comes back from a database and it can have different types, and I don't really want to write a schema for it because I just want to use the object as it comes out. So these are the four big things that the concerns that we have to address if we wanted static typing to be adopted within the company. So the approach, the hack approach is interesting, which is not we are bringing something positive. It's more you have nothing to lose. So if you take these 4 points, so first of all, too slow. So this has been a lot of work, but we made sure that even at a very, very large scale, you never have to wait. So the overall process from you are writing, you are editing your file, and the time where you see the result in the browser, all of that takes less than a second. So you're fine with that. Too verbose. The change was, in a way, exactly as verbose as before. Because in the code base, people were specifying the signatures of functions in doc blocks. So all what we did really is that we took these types and took them from comments and put them in the language. So one could argue that hack is not more verbose than what we had before in PHP. The error message, and I'll show some of that later, the error message, we worked hard on it, but basically what we did with error message is not only give you an error message, but we give you hints on how to solve the problem. And I'll say more about that. Finally, not flexible enough, aha, magic bullet, it's gradually typed. So if you don't like static typing, you can not use it whenever you choose to. So I think these four concerns were addressed. Then there's a backup plan. So we needed a strategy to make sure that when something goes wrong, we can roll back. So as I said, the conversion was not going to happen in one day. And a nightmare scenario would have been for us to convert something to a statically typed piece of code and bring the site down, for example. Facebook goes down because, you know, we added an int somewhere that is now checked at runtime. And that was a nightmare scenario for us. So we left ourselves a lot of room for mistakes. So I'll talk about the conversion specifics, but here the philosophy is we are always strictly more restrictive. So something used to work and it doesn't work anymore. So it's either the case statically in the type checker or at runtime, but that's the general philosophy. Why? Because if you are strictly more restrictive, it's easy to take it back out. So there was this thing that could do more, now it can do less, which means that if I take it back out, it still works. That's the general philosophy. Sorry. So now, I said earlier that the modes were important, and these are the three modes that work at a file level, and then I'll talk about unsafe at the end. But basically you have three modes. The first one, /strict, is basically a statically typed language. If all your code base is in strict, and that's actually a nice thing to have. So if you decide to have something, you want everything to be statically typed, easy. You put strict at the top of every single file, and everything will be checked. The default mode, and this one is the one we used extensively for the conversion, is that dynamic code is assumed to be correct. So I'll show later what it means, but when an annotation is missing, a bit like in TypeScript we've seen earlier, the any type, that's the equivalent that we have. So Deckel is interesting. So Deckel doesn't provide any checks. It's when you have code that is written in PHP and you want the interface to be typed. So you declare what the type should be, and there are no checks happening so that the hack code that is statically typed can use these types. Finally, there's a way to bail out. So for any snippet of code, you can say, type checker, shut up. I don't care what you have to say. You put // unsafe in front of it, and the type checker is just going to leave you alone. So there's always a way to bail out from type checking, should you choose to. Now, gradual typing, I took the example that I had earlier. I removed the type annotation. And basically, what you intuitively think is happening, which is that when an annotation is missing, we just assume that you know what you're doing. In that case, it looks a bit fishy because it looks like you're returning a string in a place that was used as a Boolean, but we're just going to assume that whatever you do is correct. About the error messages. So I give an example here. I think the best way to get a feel for what these error messages look like is to try online. So we have a tutorial online on hacklang.org, and you can play with the error messages. But basically, they come in multiple parts. The first line is really a normal error message that just tells you what the problem is that you would find in any programming language. The rest is more are witnesses in the source where the type inference deduced that something had a certain type. So in that case, it says there was an invalid argument on line 6, and I have two types that are incompatible. I have on one side an int, on the other a string, and it points you where it deduced that it was an int and where it deduced that it was a string. So in a way, it's telling you, if you want to fix this error, you either have to modify that one or that one. But both together, they're not going to work out. That helps a lot when you, especially when the types are coming across multiple files and when there's a type inference engine. So the rules of the language. So what that is basically the general philosophy that we followed while designing the language and the tools around it. So I mentioned that earlier, strict mode. If the entire code base is strict, then your code is type safe. And that's a nice thing to have, especially because there's always an escape patch, an escape path, sorry. So when somebody is complaining because they don't get enough checks, you can always tell them, well, add more annotations, get to strict mode, and you'll get all the checks that you want. Adding an annotation never forces you to add another, and that's a very important feature socially. So what's happening is that we have a lot of teams, different teams. They are working on different parts of the code base, and not everybody agrees on when they should convert their code to a statically typed code base, right? When or how or how they're going to go about this. If I decide to choose static typing, I can't impose it to those who still want to write dynamic code. Removing an annotation never introduces an error. And that was very important as well for migration purposes, because it allows us to be a lot more aggressive. So we can add annotations where we are not sure, and I'll show later how we did that, knowing exactly that if anything goes wrong, we can always take it out. However, it makes some language features harder to design if desirable at all, something like overloading. You have overloading depending on different, so you're going to call different methods depending on the type that you have, right? Well, if you have that and you remove a type annotation, what effect does it have on the overload dispatch? What are you calling now? So right now, we stayed away from overloading because of that specific problem. A simple mental model is basically golden rule. Whenever a programmer asks what is checked or what isn't, you should have a two-sentence answer. Something like, yes, returned types are checked. Or something where a programmer just looking at the code can know what is checked and what isn't. Be dumb by default, that's my favorite rule. And I don't know if there's a better way to express that, but we didn't try to be innovative in terms of PL or make a type system that, you know, has never seen before. What we were trying to do was just solve the problem that we have. And so what we're doing was, by default, the language is simple, dead simple and dumb. And if we get to the point where there are too many people who cannot do what they want to do, then we consider, you know, making things a bit smarter. But the default in general for the entire design was be dumb. And scale, so I won't say much about that, but it's important to keep in mind that if you want something that parallelizes heavily and that is very incremental, you need to keep that in mind when you're designing the language. So now, the conversion itself. What was the strategy? So the strategy was what I call tighten the belt strategy, for a lack of better name. Imagine you have a belt. You put it around the entire PHP code base. And at first, the belt is very loose, very little checks. I let you do a lot. You can more or less do the same things that you were used to. And then slowly tighten the belt. That's the approach that we chose. So the first thing we did is we converted everything to HH. Remember the mode that I told you about earlier, partial mode? And in that mode, if an annotation is missing, it's just assumed to be correct. So in the end, this conversion really didn't do much. That's what you would think, right? Well, it did a lot already. We got rid of the name conflicts that we had, where the same class name was used in different contexts. It eliminated some kind of basic syntax errors. I mean, old syntax, little things. And on top of that, we built awareness. So what that means is that the developers were exposed to the type checker, knew that the type checker exists, and it became part of the workflow. So building that awareness was an important process. And then once we had that coverage and we had the HH files, everything in HH, that's when we added annotations automatically. So we started, OK, now I have everything in HH. I know where everything lives, where class foo is defined, where class bar is defined. The second step is adding annotations incrementally as much as we can. So there were problems with that approach. And some people were advocating for an approach where we would have been bottom up. We would have started with a core and try to then grow from there. I don't like this approach for different reasons. The main problems that we had is the false sense of security. So people who are saying, well, there's the type checker, and I was expecting this to be caught, and it wasn't. And that's really frustrating. And I agree it is. Another thing is that the refactoring tools are kind of unusable right now. I mean, as of today, we are going to get there. And there are some places in the code base that are very well typed where they're usable. But since you know that there's still a lot of dynamic code, you don't really trust a refactoring tool that tells you that these are all the places that you have to update. And that's a bit frustrating. So how did we add these annotations? How did we tighten the belt? Well, there are three steps, and these three steps are all automated. So step one, global type inference that guesses the best it can the type of things. And this type inference is not perfect, because there's a lot of dynamic code and there are dynamic sources like databases. So this global type inference runs, it takes hours, and then deduces a bunch of types. Step two, we add annotations, but with a special tag here, an at sign. And what this at sign means is that in the first step, we're going to log. So if you pass in something that isn't a string, you don't get an error, you get a warning. And we log that warning. Then we take all these logs across the entire fleet and across multiple machines, take all these logs, and after a couple of weeks, determine if the annotation is correct or not. If it's correct, you turn it into a real type int that is going to fatal at runtime. If it's incorrect, you take it out and you file a task. So you take out the annotation, you have a stack trace, and you say, hey, we thought that this was an int, and for some strange reason, it isn't in that case. Go figure this out. And that's how we scaled the whole process of getting to a statically typed code base, since all of that is done automatically. And some part of it can be done by hand. You look at a piece of code, and you're like, that looks like an int. I'm going to put an at int. And you know that there's a tool for you 2 weeks from there or 3 weeks from now that is going to change that to a real int if you turned out to be right. So where are we at? So the blue line is the code base that is covered in HH. And the green line is the statically typed part. So we're not quite done yet with the statically typed part. The blue line, I would say we are close to done, because having 100% hack code base was a non-goal to begin with. There are third-party libraries. There's plenty of code that is written in PHP that we have no intention to convert anyway. So we are at 97%, and we're pretty happy with it. We're probably going to stay in that ballpark. What we want to do, though, is get the green line to touch the blue line. And so we're building more tools and building a lot of experience around that. And we have good hope that we can get to the blue line actually pretty fast. Now, I'm going to change gear here and change a bit the nature of the talk, but you'll see in a second why. So I have a kind of a question to ask. So one interesting side effect of that conversion process within Facebook is that people are used to constantly refactor the code base for language changes. And they're used to add changes that are more restrictive, which is pretty rare. Usually in a language change, most of the changes are extensions. In that case, on a weekly basis, you have a new rule that says, well, no, that's going to be more restrictive now. And now you can't do that. And we kind of built the habit in our, it's not a big deal. It's considered as part of the process of constantly hardening the process of programming. And so since we just open sourced, I'm wondering if that process can scale. And so this is a real question, by the way. There are some talks where, you know, people ask a question and it turns out they have the answer at the end. I don't. And I want to use this opportunity, because I know that there are a lot of people in this room who are interested in programming languages, to give me ideas, come back to me, whatever you think of this, of how we can get there. How can we make language refactor changes a habit, something that happens naturally, and making backward incompatible changes in a language easy? So maybe it's not completely crazy, because I'd like to take an analogy. So let's put our seatbelt on. We go back to the 90s. And I'd like to remind you what release day was in the 90s. So for those of you who were around, it was a nightmare. Okay, the entire company was on fire. Everybody hated each other. It was a process that was happening once every 6 months or something like that. There was a bunch of people who were working on very different branches. These branches diverged. And then there was integration engineers, remember that? Who were taking all the branches and trying to make them fit together for the release day. And so the process of releasing code has been used to be extremely painful. And today, it's kind of painless. I mean, we push twice a day. We don't even think about it. So in 10, 15 years, the process of releasing code has changed dramatically. And I'd like to use that as an analogy and try to figure out what happened. So first, there's a cultural change where people started saying, no, we have to release often. Release early, release often, and it's a good habit to release often. So there was something cultural there. But then if I look at the tooling helped with that change. Look at Git, look at Mercurial. Creating a branch in Git is a piece of cake. Rebasing from another branch is a piece of cake too. And so these tools, in a way, made natural and easy the process of staying close to master, right? So they helped a lot in that process. A lot of the code is more visible, so that helped a lot too, like GitHub. It's easy for you to follow the development of a library that you're using and see what kind of changes they're planning, et cetera, et cetera. So what used to be painful became easy. And I think that what it boils down to is that every morning we rebase. So the first thing I do when I show up at work is I take my branch and I rebase. So I never want to be too far away from master. And thanks to that, release is easy. Release is just, yeah, sure, push what I have now. It's in the right state. It's close to what I want to ship anyway, right? So Git rebase, my question is, can we build something like that for programming languages? Is there a tool, what is it? Something where I show up in the morning and I write language modernize. You know, it takes away old syntax. It refactors all these crappy APIs that nobody should be using in the first place anyway. And it does all of that for me. So again, I don't have the answer to that question. And if you have ideas, come to me later. I'd be more than happy to see how we could scale a process like that out there outside of Facebook. So if I look at the conversion process at Facebook, it's obviously just an experiment in the sense that things are different out there. But there were some lessons learned, some interesting lessons learned. So first, it's kind of large enough and small enough. So it's large enough so that there are enough different teams that don't necessarily always talk with each other, work on the same things. It's small enough in the sense that it's the same company and we can jump in and see what they're doing. So the lesson learned comes in two parts. So there's one part that is extremely incremental and the other one that isn't at all. And it will come as a surprise. So in one case, you want to be extremely incremental. You want to allow developers to decide when to convert their code, how much of it they're going to convert, and where they're going to do that. So if I work on one specific piece of code, and I have a type checker that tells me, you have to go and convert this code first, that's never going to work out. Because the developer is going to think, well, no, I care about this piece here. I don't care about this stuff over there. Right? So on one hand, an extremely incremental and very granular process. On the other hand, the complete opposite. Cases where what you want to do is flip a switch. So one example is return types. So return types used to not be checked at all at runtime. What we used to do is it was an annotation and it was just thrown away. And we wanted to check them at runtime because, you know, it's safer when it interacts with dynamic code and it could give performance optimization opportunities for the JIT. And so for that, what we did is flip the switch. We flipped the first switch that said, okay, now we're going to log on return types. And then a few weeks later, once all the logs are gone, all the warnings are gone, and everything has been cleaned up, you flip a switch again that says, now we're going to fail. We're going to fatal on return types. So why do we do it that way and not the other way? It's because we want to keep a simple model. A mental model where if a developer comes to you and asks you, so, in Hack, or at least at Facebook, what happens to return types? Are they checked or are they not? Your answer cannot be, meh, it depends. You know, in some cases it does, in some cases it doesn't. And if you want to be able to make that straight answer, you need to really flip a switch and one day and say, okay, starting today, return types are going to throw. New rule, it's going to throw. So I said that the experiment was interesting, but I'd like to stress the fact that it is not going to work out that way in the real world. And that's why I'm asking you the question, how do we scale a process like that where we're constantly refactoring for language changes outside of Facebook? Because we have a huge unfair advantage, which is that we control the code. Ultimately, I can go and talk to some guy and tell, hey, dude, don't you want to do things that way? And you're not able to do that outside of a company. Once your project is open source, there's a lot of code that you have no control over. So of course, this is just an experiment, and that's not the way it's going to scale outside of Facebook, if it does at all. So where are we at with Hack, and what are we trying to do here? So one of the things that I maybe didn't mention very much is that there was a lot of tuning going on in the design of Hack. So we had a lot of developers with a lot of feedback, and we tried to constantly tune the experience, tune the tooling, et cetera, et cetera. And what we're doing right now is basically trying to do the same thing for the open source community. We're listening to all the people who are using Hack and tuning the experience to make sure that it feels right. And we are about to provide an IDE pretty soon. And I said earlier that Hack was an IDE, which can be a bit strange because if you look at the website, there is no IDE. But we're going to release that IDE pretty soon. It's a web-based IDE, and I'd like it to be out already, but there needs to be some polishing happening. We are going to improve the language and fix, you know, the corner cases of the language and make basically carry on tightening the belt. And finishing, we want to finish the conversion, the Hack conversion internally, and get the green line to touch the blue line. And that's basically where we at with the code base today and with Hack. And that's it. Questions? Yeah. So we do that on, parameter types were always checked. So there is a subtlety that I should have mentioned, actually. Thanks, good question. PHP comes with parameter type annotations. It's just that many of the types were not supported. So what you can do in PHP is add an annotation that is a class name, and then that is checked at runtime and throws an error if there's a mismatch. And basically what we did is we extended that so that the annotations can have many different forms and can be an integer, can be a nullable type, can be more than a class name. So it wasn't a new rule for parameter types in the sense that they have always thrown, really. Yeah?
So there was a lot of focus on runtime type checking here. I'm curious why you felt like runtime type checking was so important if you already had the static checking. And just from our TypeScript experience, I felt like generally found that when you had static type checking, that caught the far majority of the errors, and that then the errors that got through that and that would only be caught by runtime type checks was a very small percentage. Even though we ended up getting very few requests for having the ability to inject the runtime type test by teams who are actually using TypeScript because they weren't seeing those problems.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering if there's a reason why that's different in PHP, or if it's coming about your experience that
Yeah, I think what's different is the JIT and the scale of it. So I know Jason is listening, so I'm going to be very careful with the words I choose. But basically, checking the type can bring performance improvement in the JIT. So the JIT is going to add a guard and then specialize the code on the code because it's an integer, because it's a string. And so since the check is there for the JIT has to prove that it's always an int, right? So for type checking purposes, you can let things flow. If you are emitting code, well, if it turns out that it's a pointer instead of an int or vice versa, you're going to segfault. So you cannot assume that it's correct. You have to emit code that is checked. And so that's one of the reasons why we check things. Yeah.
So I was curious. There's a lot of social engineering, I guess you could say, going on to get those movements through. Is there anything that you found was like friction in that social engineering that you could describe?
Huh, so you want me to trash talk. Okay, so the question is, I don't know, yeah, because of the mic. The question was there any friction, social engineering friction, because this required some social engineering to get that conversion going. Difficult question, so now I'm going to choose my word carefully again. No, I think that I would say that most of what we got was what I would call healthy skepticism. You know, when I do that all the time. So whenever I use a library, an open source library, let's say there's an open source library, and I find it interesting and I want to use it. Do I use it straight away? No. What I do first is look at how it's done. Then, you know, how seriously is it maintained? Are the people who wrote it serious about it? Can I trust the people who built that? And that's more or less what we got with the hack project. And I would say fair enough. It's actually a really good sign. With engineers saying, well, okay, I'm going to start using hack, but slowly. And I'm not going to stop everything that I'm doing just to get, you know, everything type checked. So yes, there was some friction with people saying, maybe you want to slow down a bit and take it down a notch. But nobody, or very rarely, not that I can remember of, people saying, this is really a bad idea. Let's stop what you're doing right now. Yes?
It seems like you have a really interesting opportunity here to aid language research in the sense that by having these, you know, server processes distributed everywhere that essentially do all the type checking for the code, you can collect back information about what are the most common kinds of mistakes
and
that
we do.
Developers are making. And you could also potentially help answer this open question of what are the quality differences between statically typed versus dynamically typed code. And so have you collected enough data to come to any conclusions that you can share?
Conclusions, no. So the question is, do we collect data on these daemons, these type checkers running, and have we come to any conclusion regarding that data? So we do collect data, and everything, when it comes to latency, like how long did it take you to, you know, figure out what this error was, or these kind of things. When it comes to dynamic versus static, not so much, because right now there are two different stacks. So we don't really have a good way to compare the two, because they're two different mechanisms. So with, you know, the place where we run the code is very different from the place where we develop the code. And so right now, it would be kind of complicated to make these two talk to each other or be gathered in the same way. So yes and no. Yes, we collect data. Yes, we know, you know, what are the kind of common mistakes and these kind of things. And this has influenced the design of the language, like what is a common typing mistake and what should we do to make it more efficient. No, to the question against dynamic typing. So this we haven't done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.